This off so I don't get them mixed.
I forget which is mine.
I first came in this evening. I saw all these red shirts, and I thought it was Bruce Shelton had all his firemen here. Otherwise, I didn't recognize it. Also, I was extremely pleased on arriving and seeing this keepsake about San Quentin, because that being my old school, I felt that it was in my honor that keepsake was given. And I'm embarrassed in speaking about the history of Aeclampus Vitus when I see all these red shirts, especially seeing Earl Schmidt, who is already mentioned, is giving the same talk or talk similar to the Oregon-California Trail Association. I might say, before I go into the describing what ECV is, that how many here are not clampers? Well, there's a few, so maybe I can give these old sayings that we always say about ECV. First is, what does Aeclampus Vitus mean? Well, that's the greatest mystery of all, because none of us know what it means. There is a description of the society that all of you have heard that are clampers, namely, the debate whether it was a drinking historical society or a historical drinking society, and that's never been solved. They do have the motto, as all of you clampers know, to take care of the widows and orphans, but especially the widows. That another rule in the bylaws are that all members are officers and all officers are of equal indignity. This gives a short idea of maybe some of the things. As far as the history goes, as all clampers know, no one was in any condition to take any minutes at any meeting in the old days, and the next day no one remembered anything that happened. So as a result, there's very little known as far as the background of the society. But getting down to what we do know, or think we know, the society probably had its origins in what is now West Virginia, at that time Virginia. When I speak of Virginia or West Virginia, I might use them almost the same, because the West Virginia was, of course, on the other side of the Appalachians, was a much later populated than the area towards the Atlantic side. And the ones that went in there, the people that went in there were quite a good deal different from the ones in the old section. And during the Civil War, they were pro-Union. And that resulted in the formation in 1863 of the state of West Virginia. So, while these people in time of the founding of the clampers were in Virginia, of course later they were in West Virginia. The man who was presumably the founder of the clampers was a man by the name of Ephraim B. His ancestors were ministers. They were of a group called the Seventh-day Baptists. As the name indicates, they had the Saturday is their Sabbath day. Am I talking too close to it?
No, I think I'm just turning it down a little bit.
Is
that better? Go ahead.
The family of Ephraim B. left New Jersey, according to the West Virginia article of 1931. They wanted up, I think.
Okay, go ahead.
And it. From Salem, New Jersey, where, according to the West Virginia article, Ephraim B. was born. They left Salem and went to West Virginia, or what Virginia at that time, and to a town called Salem. And I expect, I'm not positive of this, that they named that town after it. And this group, the Seventh-day Baptists, had a college there. Of course, colleges in those days were probably just like a high school. But nevertheless, they did found one in Salem, West Virginia. The county that, according to a biographical sketch of him done in the 80s, is completely different from the West Virginia article of 1931. It claims that Ephraim B. was born in Harrison County, West Virginia. Harrison County was right next to Doddridge County, the county that Ephraim B. lived in most of the time. The county of Doddridge wasn't founded or established till much later in the 1840s. So I presume that Harrison County was divided in the early 1840s. So there we have another question. Which is right, the West Virginia article? The West Virginia article of 1931, which the revivers all knew about, incidentally, was copied almost word for word for an article that was given in written in 1896. So we're going back to that date. However, in the birthplace of Ephraim B. is completely different in those two articles. One, the biographical sketch. This biographical sketch was in a book written in, I believe, 1883, and it was similar to our county histories here, the so-called mug books. And so you can take your choice. There's another thing that we clampers will have to do more study on just exactly where he was born. The date of his birth is different on the both, but not very much. The West Virginia say he was born in 1799, the other article in 1802. Ephraim B. was a member of a large family. He himself had a large family. By his first wife, he had 10 children. She died. He remarried a younger woman and had 7 more. So you can see right from the beginning, he was a real clamper. Ephraim B. Started out as a blacksmith, remained one more or less most of his life. He also was a tavern owner. He had a tavern was called the Beehive, and later on was a land speculator. I'm not saying that in any nasty way, especially with John Ritchie here, but also when the state of Virginia was West Virginia was formed, he was elected to the state legislature, the first one in 1863, and re-elected 2 years later, and again 2 years later, in 65 and 67. His was well qualified, I'm sure, to be in the assembly because his education consisted of 4 months of formal education. What I would like to mention also an article to show you sometimes that oral history and family legends has its difficulties. He had one of his sons was named Herman, and he wrote many years before he died. He died in 1954, but 20 years later in 71, there were some articles in of his life and about his father, Ephraim. And one of the things he said, his father had founded a secret society, and that was known as Clampus Vipers, V-I-P-E-R-S. And that indicates a little bit how family legends and oral history is not all it's probably said to be. Did the society there in West Virginia probably did spread. Although this article of 1931 says that it talks mostly about the 1850s, we know that it was established in other areas in the 40s. For example, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Missouri, those are all documented. And not too many years ago, Ken Castro of Murphy's found reference to a lodge in a mining community about 65 miles north of Atlanta, Georgia. That mining community, I think, is of interest because it was gold mining, established in the 1820s and finally faded out about 1860. And this mining district is not heard of very much because of the great mining rushes of later in the West. But still, it had its effect on the 49ers because the majority of the 49ers that came here didn't know nothing about gold mining. They thought they could many of them at least brought these ridiculous gold machines that didn't work. All they thought they could walk up on the hill and pick up big chunks of gold or something. The only people that taught them anything in the first year was the people from Sonora, Mexico. These people knew something about mining. And the Georgians that came out in the year of the gold rush, the 49ers, they too knew something about mining. So they also taught our own Argonauts how to mine. So they did have an effect. I think that I'm sure that there are other places in the East where there were clamper chapters. However, we don't have any documentation of them. We know also that, at least we don't know, but we think that they faded out all, and I think they faded out during the Civil War, because the young men and most of the clampers in the early days anyhow were fairly young, and that has happened again, as I will mention. Anyhow, we are up to 1849 now, and again, all books say one thing, that a person by the name of Joe Zumwalt, while on his way to California in 1849 at Bowling Green, Pike County, Missouri, in a printer's office, saw the ritual of the clampers. He put it in his luggage, went to California in 1850 in Hangtown. He attempted to have a lodge. It didn't succeed because the miners at that time were still moving very fast. They were not settled down, and so it faded. However, the next year he went to McCollumy Hill, and then that's 1850. And in 1851, he reestablished the clampers, and it, to use the expression that's been used in all the books and so on, it spread like wildfire. Now, who was that Joe Zumwalt? A member of that family not too many years ago said it was a Joseph Zumwalt, born in Indiana and left from Illinois for California. However, a new book recently, this book here, The Romance of McCollumy Hill, by another member of the Zumwalt family, said it was Joel Henry, J.H. However, the clampers in various places have made plaques and so on to Joseph. Which one is right? We know that Judge Smith of San Andreas, the late Judge Smith, was a great historian of that area, and he said it was J.H. We know that there was newspaper articles in the Marysville newspaper and in the McCollumy Hill newspaper of 1896 saying it was J.H. However, there is, as you can see, not a positive thing on this. Incidentally, Joseph died in 92, so this 96, as you see, is later than what Joseph was. Which is right, J.H. or Joseph, the one that the plaques are up for? I don't think we know. I think there's another thing about clampers, that there's a great deal more of research has to be done at some time to decide which one was really the founder in California. Then we come to as Deke has mentioned in that beautifully printed keepsake that we received tonight, how there was a debate, and still is a debate in a way, of how you spell it. Was it U.S. or S.U.S.? In the 1931 article that Carl Wheat and those thought was probably correct, they have the present spelling. However, during all of the 19th century in California, it's always SUS. Did the printer in Bowling Green make a mistake and put the extra S in? We know that in the Illinois that of 1847, they spell it only with US. However, the one in Pennsylvania has it entirely different. They have an SIS at the end. So there is, again, probably a debate or whatnot on what is the correct spelling of the order. Anyhow, as we said, it went like wildfire through California. And it naturally went to all of the leading towns, whether you were in Trinity County and or whether you were in Downeyville or further down in Nevada City, Auburn, Placerville, Sonora, Mariposa. But we also, it was in many mining camps, ones that have, some of them disappeared. Just to give you a few that is documented, and I'm sure that this is only a tiny bit of what they were. Here are some of the ones that are documented from that period. Rabbit Creek, Poker Flat, Yankee Jim, St. Louis, Sawpit Flat, Holland Flat, I can't read my writing, Springfield, Freeze Out, Spanish Flat, Port Wide, and the one that I like the best that's documented is Hell's Delight. It also, of course, was in other places, the bigger cities. In San Francisco, it was as here as early as 1852. It was in Petaluma, Benicia, Stockton, Sacramento, amongst the ones, and I'm sure in many others that we do not know or do not have documentation at the present time. It also was out of the state. In 1858, during that great Fraser River rush up to British Columbia, we had it. There was one established in Fort Douglas. That's probably natural because there were over 20,000 miners from California went on that up to that fiasco. A book recently written a number of years ago called Ghost Towns of British Columbia. It mentioned the establishment of the clampers in Fort Douglas, and I wrote to the editor to the author. And I got a letter back that was rather amusing. He said he came in the letter from his lunch, and I'd written it on stationery of Eclampus Vitus. And he said he saw this envelope with Eclampus Vitus on the outside, and he thought he was seeing a ghost. It was also, maybe not as in the Comstock lode during that period. Of course, it was in Virginia City and Carson City. And another place, I'm not sure it was ever established, but in the 1850s, there was a notice in a Honolulu paper of a calling a meeting of the clampers. Whether it ever got established, I don't know. But it's still, these things are all just documentation, but very little, and no one has ever gone into, for instance, looking into the archives in Hawaiian Islands or anything else to see whether it really was established. Most of the people that revived the HCV was of the opinion, as the mining towns and the mother lode sort of faded, so did ECV. And that is true to a certain extent. They were of the opinion that by the turn of the century, the clampers had really disappeared. However, we know that it hadn't. We knew that in the 1890s, it was still existing in Sierra City, Downeyville, and Marysville, and probably other places. But there is also, in the last number of years, quite a number of other places have been found. For example, there were in Willows, Colusa, Marysville from at least 1911 to 1912. And Jim Knapp gave a personal story about his initiation in Nevada City in 1908. And his son, Deke, lives down in your area, Gordon Knapp, and maybe he has some information, I don't know, about his father's initiation in 1908. But it was a period, we used to call the Dark Ages, but apparently not entirely. The one that I think is interesting is a 1918 or 1917 affair at Quincy, and I have pictures of it down at the end of the room. And that, I think, is interesting because they had this big parade with photographs and so on, and it was written up in a newspaper. I have a photo set down at the back. And that, the Plumas National Bulletin, on one side it said that the United States votes for war against Germany. The other side, one half, says the Quincy Clampers buried the hammer with great plan. So they had the same front page. One side, we declared war. The other side, the Clampers marched. I believe that the Clampers, like they did in the East in 1861 during the Civil War, I think the same thing happened in World War I. The if there these few places that had Clampers, like Quincy and so on, they apparently died out. Because in the 1920s, we know of no action. And certainly Carl Wheat and those that refounded it were of the opinion there was no, the Clamper lodges had disappeared completely. The story that Carl Wheat wrote about the revival, he always had a rather sensational or interesting story, which I don't believe is entirely true, but he said that he was driving with George Ezra Dane between Columbia and Parrott's family, a ferry. And on the trip, he turned to George Dane and said, "Let's revive the Clampers." Well, I had, Carl gave me in his last illness, which was long and disabling, some of his material. And in it, I found where he had put aside different little articles that he found in books and so on about Clampers. So he'd been thinking about that for a long time, I believe. The other founder, besides Dane, was Leon Witzel. Leon Witzel was interested in history. He was a high official in the Masonic Order, and I believe, I'm not positive of this, that he wrote a history of the Masonic Order in California, of several volumes. Dane was a lawyer, like attorney, like Carl Wheat was. In fact, they were in the same office for a while. His writings, which many of you have read, were amazing. And unfortunately, after he had published his last book, which was called Ghost Town, it was a story of Columbia, and a fine book, and only a short time afterwards, he had a tragic ending. He was 37 at that age, and this was in, I think, around 41. I'm not positive of that. I've forgotten. But it means that he was only in his 20s when he was one of the refounders of ECV. And that mean, and I hunted up what Carl Wheat's age was at that time, and I believe he was only in his early 40s. So these people that I remember, like Carl Wheat and so on, as older men and so on, they were extremely young in 1930 when they began to think about the revival. In 31, they had their first meeting in the Cliff Hotel. Mr. Cliff was one of the charter members, incidentally. And in 32, they went off on their first trek, their first established where they had a Noble Grand Humbug and so forth. I always interested in the letter, I have the original here, of they were going up to Camptonville, which is above to the north of Nevada City. And I thought the prices are interesting. It was written by William Bull Meek. There's a chapter named for him, as you know, up in Nevada City. He was a justice of peace, and this is written on the stationery of the Justice Court of Campton Town Township. And he wrote, I'll read a little bit of it. I think it's sort of it. In reply to your letter, this is to Carl Wheat. In reply to your letter of the first, I'm glad to learn that the E. Clampus Vitus is being revived and hope that the new life of the order will be as complete as the original. William Bull Meek, as we'll speak later, was a Clamper. Mr. Labadie passed away this winter, but Mrs. Labadie still conducts the hotel. I have spoken to her in regards to your coming, and she says she will, quotes, a rate of $1 per person for room and 50 cents for meal. She has rooms enough to accommodate about 34 people. Well, these clampers that went up there are all affluent, so, but I can't get over that, how prices have changed a wee bit on clamper treks. After that trek, Wyakoss Clamper Dunn proceeded to enlarge and so on. I might mention that in these West Virginia articles, they say that the clampers were a takeoff or a mockery of the secret political societies of that time, the Sons of 76, the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, etc. And these organizations merged later, for the most part, into the American Party, the Know-Nothing Party. And I could, that party, as you know, was extremely powerful for a short time, especially in the early 50s, politically. And I can see why they possibly were. Not that I approve of them, don't misunderstand it. Because these were mostly Anglo-Saxons descendants or Scotch-Irish or something like that. And when they saw in the early, in the late 40s and early 50s, the hundreds of thousands of people coming from Europe, which were of different background and different religion. The Irish were coming because of the potato famine, and from the continent, all of these people coming after the revolts, especially of 48. And I can see it. See something of a change of the country, something like we're having right now with the Hispanic and others that were coming into California, into United States. And those changes come, and that I think I can understand why these parties were powerful for a short time. And I'm certainly not from that original background, incidentally. I'm immigrant myself. Where were we? Where did I get? I got off on the wrong thing, on a political thing. The Constitution, or whatever you want to call the bylaws of the CHS, of the E. Clampus Vitus, were established in 1939. And about that time, Carl Wheat went to Washington, and Lee Stoppel was in charge. And Lee Stoppel wanted, was NGH in, for the chapter here, and wanted to incorporate. But he found that the Marysville group had incorporated in 1915. So he went up in 1940 to Marysville, gathered those survivors of the old group, and made a merger. And from then on, of course, the Clampers have had their incorporation papers. In another find, if you want to call it that, of Carl Wheat, was the finding of Adam Lee Moore. Adam Lee Moore had been the last NGH of Balaam Lodge in Sierra City, or as he called it, Sierra City. And he was been a stagecoach driver, amongst things. He was a remarkable man. He lived to be they always said 100 years. I think he was only 99 when he died. But anyhow, he was quite a person. And I remember one incident, if I can give some personal things. I was in a car which Carl Wheat was, Lee Stoppel was driving with a lady that later became his wife. And in the back seat, I was with Adam Lee Moore and his wife. And it was a long drive to Downeyville. We were returning the new chapter, a new charter to Downeyville. And it was a meeting of the initiation, and the initiation was at night. And I was a lot younger and a lot easier to be shocked. And I know I was shocked when the PBCs came down the main street of the town. There were many of them holding torches, and they were singing that thing of, "Poor sons of bitches, he Clampus Vitus, poor." Well, I'd never heard that in public before, and I must say I was a little cut out. And after this, we know we had a long drive. And then this, initiation. And I said to Adam, I said, I'm going to bed. And I never forget his answer. And he was 93 or 4 then. He said, ain't you going to the dance? And he went. When we get to Carl Wheat, really the person that founded it, I have to go and say that he was the most remarkable man I ever met. He had many, many things that he did besides being reviving the ECB, being the first Nobel Grand Humbug in the San Francisco chapter, in the Los Angeles chapter. He was founded the Roxburgh Club in San Francisco. He was one of the earliest ones in the Zamorano Club. He was a director of the California Historical Society. He was the editor of their quarterly. He had his own printing press because he was interested in printing, called the Wheatstock. He was in the federal government during the war, and many the attorney of a repute, and so on. I could go on in many other things. And I had the pleasure of making some trips with him, and always I was amazed. One, I remember, again to Downeyville, when he was going to dedicate a plaque to Adam Lee Moore. And as in the front seat was Dr. John Lawrence, head of the Dunnell Laboratory at Cal and a brother of Ernest, Lawrence Laboratory now. And he, in the front seat, discussed nuclear medicine, just like his knowledge of anything, I think, was amazing. Another thing he did I never would do when I was drive right to the place, but he had to go off on every dirt road between Comptonville and Downeyville to show us some building, some mine, something. He knew the area perfectly. He was an amazing, amazing man. We could tell many, many stories about him. He wrote the present bylaws, the ones that created the Grand Council of Venerable Clan Patriots. Before that, of course, had just been directors of the corporation. The Clampers, like all other organizations during World War II, was sort of died out. Not didn't die out, but was sort of wasn't much action. But when Carl Wheat returned in the late 40s from Washington, why, things changed, and he put in new directors. I was appointed a director by Wheat in 1950, and I wasn't an NGH either at that point, but he was an amazing man. He wrote the articles in the meeting of the directors in 1954. They were more or less accepted, and then in 56, and I believe it was in Fresno, we again said, yes, we'll do that, and the first real in 56 wasn't at Fresno. It was the first time we went to Murphy's. And the second time in 57 was when the Ed Jessup became the first Sublime Nobel Grand Humbug, although I think Carl was in for a few seconds or something, and then they made Ed Jessup Sublime Nobel Grand Humbug. Let me see how my time is going. We could go on, but I don't want to talk forever here. Well, it's getting a little late. Let me tell you one thing, a couple of one story I always like, and that is the initiation of Lord Sholto Douglas. And a chapter is named for him in Auburn. So maybe I would tell you a little bit about that, about him. As you know, he was the son of the Marquess of Queensberry, and those of you that know anything about fighting, of course, have heard of his name. He was also a brother of Lord Alfred Douglas, and Lord Alfred Douglas was a poet who was involved in the escapades of Oscar Lewis, with Oscar Lewis landed in jail. Now, of course, they would have just taken a...
Oscar Wilde!
With Oscar Wilde. What did I say?
Oscar Lewis is a member!
I'm thinking of a very good friend of mine, Oscar Lewis. And a wonderful man, now a great clamper, who made many trips to Quincy and Mariposa, etc. But we're getting back to Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde landed in jail, and I always thought in today what would happen. He and Lord Alfred would just take a plane trip and come right to San Francisco. But anyhow, our friend Lord Sholto Douglas was a completely different type of man, and he married a young lady by the name of Loretta Mooney in San Francisco. She was under the delusion that she was a singer and dancer and an actress. And off they went on a trip. In Sacramento, they failed. And in Oroville, I always liked that difficulty that he had there. The way the newspapers, I can't find my notes, but I can quote it anyhow. He got in an argument with the person in charge of the music, that claiming they didn't do well for his wife. And anyhow, to quote the newspaper of Oroville, when it said that Sholto Douglas, left the town with his left optic in deep mourning. These newspaper articles of that period I thought were always good. Anyhow, we went up to Marysville. Nobody came to the first night, so the Clampers took over the second night, and they sold the place out and initiated them. And I'll tell you about the initiation in a minute, but I want to go on to what happened to Lord Sholto. He came back to the San Francisco and finally landed up in Richie's old town in Spokane and opened a saloon. It failed, of course, and he went back to Europe. And later, to make this thing short, he was divorced and remarried. And his second wife was a very, very wealthy woman in Paris. She had five husbands in all. Lord Sholto was a third. He was divorced from her and married a third time. Then he had a suit, and I think that suit is rather interesting because he was had married, as I said, on his third marriage, and he sued his former wife, who was then married to her fourth husband, on the basis that she wasn't giving a certain amount of money to each month to his first wife. I hope you follow me on that. Anyhow, he lost the suit. And Carl Wieck wrote a letter to him in the 1930s to the southern part, south of France, but he never got an answer back. I might mention or read, if I can find it, about that what William Bull Meek, who was a witness of this, said. Here it is. I'm not going to read the whole letter, but this is written to Carl Wieck. And is by William Bull Meek. Quote, I can still see the expression on Lord Sholto's face with the closing poem was repeated to him by the Grand Hangman after he had passed through the ceremonies of our order. Quote, when you have crossed the river and joined the immortal class, you will thank the boys of Marysville that made you a horses. Let's get serious when I conclude. I'm not concluding right till I tell you about what a marvelous patriotic order the ECV is. As you know, in 1937, one of the great finds occurred where they found the Drake plaque up here a few to the north, wherever you want to put it. Anyhow, the Drake plaque, what does it say? May I read it? That's the wrong one. Here. In the year, this is what Drake left up there on the plaque. In the year of grace 1579, the great hi-ho of the Miwoks. I had the right one first. But it be known to all men by here present, June 17th, 1579, by the grace of God, in the name of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth and of England and her descendants, I take possession of this kingdom where the king and people freely reign, the right and title to this whole land in Her Majesty's can't read my own writing. Well, anyway, you get the idea. When that news came, there was great, great disturbance in Washington, D.C., especially in the White House. Already, FDR was having his difficulties with the Hitler regime where the horrors of humbuggery had raised its ugly hand. But this was just another thing to bother him. What happened then? The clampers, always a patriotic order, took it in hand. And they went up to an Indian reservation outside of Tuolumne City. And this was in the Memorial weekend of 37. And I remember it well because I was a PBC. And to be a little personal on the thing, I'd like to tell you that I was invited to become a clamper by a schoolmate of mine at grammar school and high school, Edgar Kahn, Cable Car Kahn, as we called him. Anyhow, Edgar was rather serious in some ways, and he said to me, Al, he said, don't bring any liquor because it's an Indian reservation, it's illegal. Also, he said, clampers are hardy, bring a sleeping bag. And I did. And first we had an Indian dinner. It was, I'll never forget it because I didn't eat it. It was it was fried grasshoppers and acorn bread. Try it sometime. Anyhow, I put my sleeping bag down on the hard, cold ground, and every clamper that had any sense left and went down to the hotel and to the nearest bar. Hardly had I put it down than these Indians that had given us all these dances and all that horrible food, they started eating hot dogs, and they had hired a Filipino band, jazz band, who came and started to play. They brought out whiskey from every place and got drunk as skunks. So much for that. Now going back to what happened there. Now I'll give you read the correct, I hope I do, I don't pull the wrong one. But anyhow, this was on the clamper plaque. Mind you, that plaque of Drake said the Mihawk Indians, or insinuated. Well, they were the Coast Mihawks, and these ones under Chief Fuller, who became a clamper, incidentally, were the same nation, the same tribe of Indians. And they had the perfect right to do this. And this is on the plaque that may or may not be still there. But anyhow, it's the clamper plaque. Be it known unto all men that are present on June 17th, let me see if I got the wrong one that I just read. Yeah, that's the wrong one. Yes, in the year of grace of 1579, the great Hiowa of the Mihawks was seduced by that buccaneer Francis Drake to deliver this land of Nova Albion to Elizabeth, queen and her successors forever. Now I, the present chief and Hiowa of the Mihawk nation, do now revoke the said grant on this grounds of deceit, fraud and failure to occupy the said domain, May 29th, 1937, William Fuller, and so forth, in presence of the clampers. But you can see, now, you will not find that in your textbooks of your children. You will not, you will find it in the clamper books. You do not find it in the standard histories. But do the clampers ever resent that? No. Why? Because they are a meek group, a self-effacing group, a group that would never try to blow their horn or have anything like that. We give aid to the widows, but do we expect to be thanked? Do we expect them to say satisfactory? No. We're a very I guess self-effacing group or whatever you want to call it. Anyhow, I have it absolutely from a person of prominence. I cannot mention his name, but he was in the Washington, D.C. at that time, and he said that President Roosevelt, it was the first time he'd seen him smile in a long time when he heard about this, because he knew that our glorious state would still remain a part of the Union. Now, what would have happened otherwise? Probably we would have been under the yoke of an English tyrant king. But what has happened? That you and your children are still under this flag, this glorious star-spangled banner. Thank you.
Perfect timing, we still had tape.